books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got two category winners from the Nero Book Awards. Adam S. Leslie with Lost in the Garden and Liz Hyder with The Twelve. Winner of the 2024 Nero Book Award for Children's Fiction is The Twelve by Liz Hyder. The judges said, beautiful characterisation, compelling storytelling. This is a book for now and all time. An immense time travel adventure that will keep readers hooked. Now, while The Twelve is available from RNIB in Braille, the audio version of The Twelve is yet to be recorded, although it is promised to be on its way very soon. While we look forward to that, let's hear about The Twelve from author Liz Hyder.
The Twelve, yeah, it's a time slip adventure, really. So it's set on the wild Welsh coast in the sort of depths of winter, and it's set just around winter solstice in 1999, so sort of on the cusp of a new century, but also a new millennium. And it tells the story of Kit, who's 15, who's sort of being dragged off on holiday to a caravan park in the middle of nowhere on the Pembrokeshire coast with her mum and her younger sister, Libby. And on winter solstice, Libby vanishes, but she doesn't just vanish. She's blinked out of existence so that Kit's own mum doesn't remember her. No one else remembers her apart from Kit. Except then Kit does find that there is one other person, a local boy, who remembers her as well. And so that they must team up to try and rescue her sister, find out what's happened and heal a rift in time that threatens to destroy everything they've ever known, really. But in order to do that, they have to find out who and what the 12 are, for they hold the key.
Now, does that actual piece of coastline exist, or did your author's mind rearrange it somewhat?
No, do you know what? I did actually, it is exactly as it is in the book. So there's a little village called Manabir, which is an extraordinary little place. And it's just sort of around the Pembrokeshire coast from kind of Tenby. And I came across it on a walk, and it's just incredibly atmospheric. And it's got lots of sort of ingredients from what I would say a kind of classic children's book. So it's got a ruined castle. It's got this sort of strange, very atmospheric ancient church with a really kind of bright white tower. And at the top of the tower, there are these black windows, and they're sort of smeared underneath as if it's been kind of crying and all its makeup's run. And it's also got a Neolithic kind of burial tomb out on the headland. And these three buildings are just, none of them seem to quite be in the right place somehow. And I just felt when I was there that there was sort of something in the air, almost like a tuning fork, like a note in the air that I thought, I have to come back. There's a story here. So I went back to kind of unearth it. But no, it's very much a real place, yeah.
So the physical setting is quite important to the book. What about the setting in time of using 1999 in the millennium? Is that important to the story?
Yeah, it is actually. And I mean, a couple of people have sort of asked, oh, is it because you didn't want to use modern mobile phones? And phones are very much in the story. They play a kind of quite an important role in keeping in touch with sort of back home. And Kit is being bullied at school. And so one of the bullies has got hold of her new number and is sort of texting her really passive aggressive messages. And I wanted that to be very much a part of the book, but also because I think I wanted to play with the idea of sort of ancient belief systems and like ancient kind of almost like gods and sort of pagan figures, and that whole idea around solstice and that there's a kind of power in the sort of the death and the return of the sun, like, you know. So I wanted to play with all of those things, and also because there was a kind of great conjunction where the planets kind of come together at a certain point, and that happened then as well. So yeah, lots of reasons I set it then, really.
Now, a couple of years ago, I had the great fortune to talk to Alan Garner when his book Treacle Walker was up for the Booker Prize. And one of the descriptions of Treacle Walker is myth and folklore and an exploration of the fluidity of time. There are a few similarities there. Are you a fan of Alan Garner?
Yeah, a huge fan. I didn't read him as a child, actually. I didn't come across his work. I don't quite know why. Both him and Susan Cooper, who I love, I didn't really come across until I was an adult. But no, I think Garner's extraordinary. And I think the sort of he's got better and better over the years, even though you sort of think that's not possible. But Treacle Walker is one of my favourite books, but also Boneland. I think Boneland is just exceptional. I've read it probably about 5 times, and each time I read it, I swear it's changed. It's almost like the book equivalent of Smoke, that you can't quite grasp it somehow. It's extraordinary. I think that he's got an extraordinary mind.
Now, Kit in the book is a, I'll find this phrase hard to say, a bird nerd. Does that come from you?
A bird nerd. Yeah, I am a bit. I am a little bit nerdy when it comes to birds. I mean, to wildlife in general. I've always been sort of interested in wildlife. I'm the youngest of three, and my brother's always been quite interested in sort of like digging holes and seeing what else is around. Like, oh, there's a worm or there's a beetle or whatever. Yeah, so I am a bit of a bird nerd, but I'm just sort of interested in everything really. The boy kind of character in The 12, who has named himself Story after his kind of sort of favourite astronaut. He's a bit of an astronomy nerd, and I'm very interested in that as well. So I can't deny it. I'm just a nerd,
That's what I was going to say. That's my next question. Where did Story get his name?
I must admit, I'm not normally a fan of whimsical names. If something that I kind of, if I sort of hear or see on the back of a book on the blurb, I think, oh no, if they're called sort of like Marvelous Ways or something, I just think, oh no, I don't know if this is a book for me. But I wanted him to be rooted in reality, and so we don't find out what his birth name was, but we know that he's changed it to Story in honor of Story Musgrave, who is genuinely an extraordinary man. Please go and look him up, he's amazing. So he's the most educated person ever to go into space. I think he's got like 8 or 9 degrees, and he's a true polymath, and he's just funny and charming and wonderful. And I came across him on a documentary about the Hubble Space Telescope years ago, and I just could not believe that that was his real name, but also that everyone who spoke about him just loved him, that he's one of life's true enthusiasts for whatever subject he's talking about. And yeah, I just think he's incredible.
Going back to the fluidity of time, I was quite fascinated by something you said about the fact that we've got the same brain as people had 5,000 years ago, so they would be able, given a bit of time, to navigate an iPad. And yet, if we went back 5,000 years ago, we'd be dead within a week.
Yeah, I think we often underestimate the past. I think we often have this thing of kind of like, oh, humans can't have built the pyramids, so it must have been aliens, or humans can't possibly have kind of aligned the stones at Stonehenge and numerous other kind of circles and monuments across so many different countries. They couldn't possibly have done that. It must be something magic or supernatural. And I just think we underestimate them really. And it's true. I mean, my survival skills would be pretty poor. I might be all right in the kind of summer, but this time of year, I'd be like, not much to eat out there. I think I'll just have to starve, Whereas someone from the past, if you put them into now, I think, like I say, like thousands of years, I think they'd be all right. Their brains are the same as ours, but they just have really, really good survival skills, and frankly, very few of us do.
Now, in your writing, how much of a plotter are you?
It does depend on the book. I do plot it out because I want to make sure that there is a logic to it, and also that I don't sort of cheat in terms of time, or that people can't get, can get from one place to another in the right time. I do plot it out, but there is always flexibility in it. I don't plot it out so tightly that there's no kind of room for maneuver. So I am a plotter rather than a pantser, I believe is the phrase, but I do always leave enough space so that the characters just end up doing things that surprise me. And then I have to work out how to get them out of that situation. But yeah, no, I'm definitely a plotter.
What is your writing process?
It's a lot of thinking, which probably isn't helpful to people listening. I do a lot of thinking. So I know when I think that I've got an idea, and then I normally let it simmer for a while. But then it just takes over my head and it takes over my brain, and I almost can't sort of hold a conversation with people about other subjects, where it just completely subsumes me. And then I have to try and work out what the structure is. I have to try and work out more details about the character, and then I start the process of sort of putting it down. But I will spend ages and ages and ages thinking about it before I ever put pen to paper, really. So it's normally at least a year. It's normally a kind of maybe a couple of years. Some projects maybe take longer. Yeah, and then I write it really quickly. I normally write my first draft in 4 to 6 weeks.
That's quick.
Yeah, and I don't recommend it. It's a stupid way of doing it. I'll normally feel quite ill at the end and knackered, so I really wouldn't recommend it. But I think there's something about just trying to get it all out that creates pace in the work itself. And also, I'm a boom or bust person. I don't know another way of doing it. So yeah, I've never been someone who could just sit and write 500 words a day. I'll either sit and write 5,000 or I'll write none. You know, it's kind of. But like I say, I don't recommend it. Don't do it at home, people.
Bear Mouth, written by Liz Hyder and read by Kit Griffiths. I am learning my letters. I am learning my letters. I am learning my lettuce. I am learning my letters. I am learning my letters.
And, well, your debut novel, well, what you say is your debut novel, the first novel you published, I'm sure there's a drawer full of novels like I have myself that haven't gone anywhere. But tell us about Bear Mouth.
So Bear Mouth, you're right, it is my debut published book. It was the seventh book that I'd written, and it's important to say that for aspiring writers. It's not always your first one that gets published. Bear Mouth is a dystopian thriller set down a working coal mine, but my kind of little twist is that the workers both live and work down the mine. And it tells the story of Newt, who's young and is beginning to question what they're all doing there, beginning to question the sort of the authority that keeps them there. And then a new boy, Devlin, comes in and sets about kind of, it's like a little spark that is lit between them.
Let's hear a clip from the audio version as read by Kit Griffiths.
Better, says Thomas, as he blows out the light. 'Tis hard work, using my brain. Thomas teaches me at lunch, when the others are at cabin, and sometimes on Maker's Day, I have lessons after prayers. In the week, the men sit and discuss things for grown-ups at cabin, and us youngs aren't allowed in. Men's talk, they say, not for youngs.
I kind of don't want to give too much away because it's a book about revolution, and it's a book about challenging the authority and about asking the question why, really. But I should say it's written first person in a dialect that I kind of made up. So it's an intense book, and I wouldn't invent a new dialect again, perhaps. And I should say Newt is learning to read and write, and so the spellings in the book get better as the book goes on because Newt is learning more and more words and how to communicate, really. It is a book about the power of communication and again about the power of stories.
Can we briefly touch on your adult novels, The Gifts and Illusions, which, again, as with Bear Mouth, are available in audio commercially? Let's start with The Gifts. Can you tell us about The Gifts?
It's set in 1840, it's set in England, and it's sort of historical fiction with a kind of dash of fantasy in the opening scene. The main character grows a huge pair of wings, and there's a surgeon in London who's very ambitious and wants to sort of make his mark. And there's an aspiring young journalist, young writer. There's four women and kind of the male surgeon, and their lives all kind of become entwined, leading to, yeah, disastrous sort of consequences, really. It's a sort of historical thriller, but yeah, with a kind of element of fantasy. As far as I know, no one grew wings in 1840, but who knows?
She held her palms in front of her, turned them over and examined them. Flesh over bare bone, knuckle and sinew. A flash of understanding. A moment of wonder deep in her heart and brain alike. Was this what Scout's soft, leathery paw had been hiding, too? A hand more like hers than she could have imagined. And what of his heart? His brain? Her mind had whirled, spun on its heel, and fizzed off in a million and more different directions. Had that not been less than an hour since? She gags again, a dry, empty bark like a wounded fox. Harder this time, more painful. The next wretch throws her to her knees at the edge of a small clearing, palms damp on the forest floor. The sun disappears behind the clouds for a moment, throwing her into the forest's grey shadows. She cries out, roars, as a searing pain cracks across her back, twists her agonizingly over herself, once, twice, and then a third and final time. The wind drops.
That's Tuppence Middleton reading from The Gifts by my guest Liz Hyder. And you follow that up with The Illusions. Now, I love Carter versus the Devil, so this is went straight to the top of my TBR pile. So tell us about The Illusions.
So The Illusions is sort of, it's quite different to The Gifts, actually. So The Gifts is 1840, and I kind of wanted to write something that bookmarked the Victorian era. So you've got very early, and then I wanted to do something at the end. So it's set in 1896 in Bristol, and it explores the frankly quite unbelievable real life overlap between a golden age of magic and really early film pioneers. And almost all of the characters in it are inspired by real life kind of British counterparts who, unless you are a pretty extreme early film geek, you will never have heard of.
A storm is coming. It lingers in the air, dances in the trees, and blows at the roof tiles, trying to prise them from their holds. The rusting weather vane at the top of St. Andrew's rattles, swinging in circles at the sudden gusts and gales that make the church's resident barn owls hide in the bell tower, huddled together for warmth. Beneath them, a small crowd of men and women gather in the midst of the graveyard, holding tightly onto their hats and bonnets as the wind tries to cast them off into the black of the night. Arthur Evans, an aging con artist with a knack for the theatrical, tries his best to hold both their attention and his lantern, a battle he is in danger of losing. The deep and often empty pockets of Arthur's frayed woolen coat carry a smattering of coins from his audience, and they clink faintly as he picks up a small bell from the top of an old headstone. His accomplice, 16-year-old Cecily Marsden, barely hears the bell ring from where she hides, crouched behind a large moss-covered gravestone in the far corner of the dank churchyard. The wind is doing its best to steal the sound away, but Cess, as she prefers to be called, is focused entirely on something else, something impossible.
That's Anna Burrett reading from The Illusions by Liz Hyder. And at the beginning, we heard Kit Griffiths reading from Bearmouth. Now, do you have a hand in the casting of the audio versions of your books?
I did for Bearmouth, actually. And I have to say, I really want to say this because Kit Griffiths is just the most extraordinary performer. I feel so blessed that Kit kind of did Bearmouth. And actually, the character of Kit in The Twelve is sort of partly named after Kit Griffiths, because I just think they're the most amazing performer and can do so many different things. There is that kind of polymath ability to Kit where, you know, she's an artist, she's a poet, she's a performer, she's a drag king. She does about a million and one things, and she does them all to, frankly, an exceptionally high level that makes me feel frankly jealous. So, yeah, Kit's extraordinary. So I had a say in that. Tuppence, I mean, what a joy to be for someone to say Tuppence Middleton's going to read your book. I mean, I'm a huge fan of hers. And the same with Anna. Anna is utterly extraordinary. So I didn't have a say for my grown-up books, but I'm lucky enough that, you know, that they just pick amazing people because that's their sort of expertise. And I'm not sure who's going to read The 12 yet, but I'm really excited to find out. It's going to be great.
That's what I was going to say. We haven't got an audio version of The 12 yet, but it's certainly on its way.
It's on its way, yeah. And it should be on its way fairly soon. So I've sort of kind of sitting, fidgeting in my chair, waiting to hear, you know, who it's going to be. But I think it will be a really interesting one, you know, to have as an audio book.
Now that they are available in audio and The 12 is available in Braille from RNIB, that means it's accessible to anyone for whatever reason, dyslexia, sight loss, doesn't have access to print. Is that important to you?
Yeah, really important. I think there can be a real snobbery in sort of the kind of publishing world where like audiobooks aren't reading. Of course they're reading. I don't understand. Why would you not want your stories out there in as many different kind of formats as possible so as many different people can experience those stories? And I think for me, audiobooks are the sort of essence of storytelling. With when I write, I always read my work back to me. So by the time the book is actually published, I've read it out loud quite a lot to make sure that kind of that the sentences flow in the right way, because that oral storytelling, that's where all our storytelling comes from. It comes from people sharing stories around a campfire. And that's kind of something that comes up in the 12, that sort of the importance of stories and the importance of sharing stories is kind of crucial. So yeah, of course, I love it. The more the merrier. Share more stories.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do, not as much as I want to, because I tend to work when I'm on the move. So if I'm on a train, I'm working. And so the time that I would listen to audiobooks, I can't, because I just get too subsumed into the story. It's too distracting for me. And particularly when you've got a really, really good sort of audio reader, they're performing it. And I cannot ignore it. It's too distracting. I used to work at Radio 4. And I would find it terribly distracting when sort of like the afternoon play was on, or book of the week, you know, because when you hear someone performing with passion, you just can't help but listen. So no, I do listen to audiobooks, but nowhere near as much as I would like to.
Now, we'll miss, if we're getting the Braille version or the audio version, we'll miss the cover of the 12. Can you give us a little description of it?
Yeah, it's by a fantastic artist, actually, called Tom DeFreston. So he did the cover artwork, and there are illustrations within the book as well. There's a standing stone circle and these sort of beautiful kind of strange sort of starry sky behind that almost looks a little bit Northern Lights. There's like blues and greens in it. And then there's the figure of a young girl with red boots just falling on the top right hand side. So it's almost a slightly kind of Alice in Wonderland-y image. Yeah, it's an incredible cover. And then on the back of the book, there is the strange white tower of the church in Manabir as well. It's a really lovely kind of fold around cover. You can hear me playing with it, stroking it. It's a very tactile cover, I think.
Liz Hunter, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
On today's Read On, we're looking at two category winners from the Nero Book Awards. We've heard from children's fiction winner Liz Hyder. And hopefully in a future show, we'll hear about Morris and Marilyn by Sophie Elmhurst, winner of the non-fiction award. And Wild Houses by Colin Barrett, winner of the debut fiction novel award. But for now, winner of the Nero Book Award category of fiction is Lost in the Garden by Adam S. Leslie. The judges said, a surprising folk horror about everyday encounters with the incredible. Vulnerable, rooted characters come of age in a hazy, hypnotic book that reflects contemporary Britain through a distorted lens. We'll hear from author Adam S. Leslie in a moment, but for now, the audio version of Lost in the Garden is read by Fran Burgoyne.
Ice cream van chimes elicit a synesthetic Pavlovian response. The sound tastes of vanilla. It tastes of chocolate flake and neon red spirals of strawberry sauce. It tastes of all the myriad possibilities illustrated in lurid colour beside the serving hatch. A miniature church cast in pinks and yellows and powder blues, its oversaturated bells calling the children of the parish to worship. The communion wafer, the communion soft whip ice cream, the blessed chocolate flake rearing from its icy white hillock like the pole of the holy crucifix, waiting for the crossbeam, waiting in giddy anticipation to receive the condemned Christ in his martyrdom, and the swirl of strawberry sauce right at the very end, representing the blood of our Lord swirling down the hill of Golgotha.
So Lost in the Garden, it's a folk horror novel, but it's more folk than horror. So it's not a Stephen King kind of thing with lots of spurting and heads rolling off or any of that kind of thing. It's much more about the atmosphere of it and the unsettling, uneasy tone.
It was 6 years at least since Heather had last heard the chimes of an ice cream van. 6 years since the rattly metallic music had drifted across the foot of her street. half a pound of tuppenny rice, half a pound of treacle, then turned the corner onto Catswort Drive, the way it always did, parking up across the road from the post box, engine thrumbling. And then, after the momentary shock had subsided and before delight had fully set in, the race against time, pulling on shoes, collecting stray coins, corralling family members, herding everyone outside before the van hoisted its skirts and wended its inscrutable way to a more remote part of the village. You had to be quick. The ice cream van was not a patient creature.
It's about three friends. The central character is Heather, and her on-off boyfriend has gone to the distant village of Almondby. So it's set in this rural landscape, but reality has become sick or septic, and strange things have started happening. So geography is no longer a fixed thing. It'd be quite fluid now, or things subtly change. Your doors will change colour, or animals will change gender suddenly overnight, and that kind of thing. And there are also manifested physical ghosts wandering around the countryside. So it's that's the setting. And there's a village that they've been warned against since childhood that they shouldn't visit. It's called Almondby. So it's one of those things. It's like, don't talk to strangers, don't play on the farm, don't climb the pylons, don't go to Almondby. But no one's ever explained why they shouldn't go to Almondby. It's just one of those things that the characters grow up knowing, but never really questioning. No one said why. It's just one of those things you've always known, don't go to Almondby. And no one's ever even said, really said whereabouts it is. But one day, Heather's on-off boyfriend, he's her on-off boyfriend, but it's a bit of a one-sided relationship. She's playing it cool, but she's secretly quite in love with him. One day he announces that he's going to Almondby, but he also doesn't say why. He doesn't say how he knows how to get there. But he just said, he says he has to go. He has to do something there, and she can't talk him out of it. And he says, "Look, it'll be fine. I promise. I'll be back here in 3 weeks. 3 weeks' time, I'll be standing in front of you, and everything'll be fine." 6 months later, no sign of him. She hasn't heard anything from him. He's effectively disappeared, except on her little shortwave radio. Amongst all the weird shortwave radio noise, she can hear what sounds like his voice, just intoning strange, broken, nonsensical sentences and sounding quite unwell. And that's the only trace of him that she has. And her friend Rachel has a package that she has to take to Almondby. She also refuses to say what's in the package, but she has to take a package there. So they rope in a third friend who can drive because the other two can't, and they set off towards Almondby, mainly to find Stephen, who's gone missing. But, of course, in doing this, they also are about to find out what happens in Almondby and why you shouldn't go there. So that's the setup, and then it's about their journey to Almondby and what happens when they get there.
6 years ago, a different kind of pollen drifted in on the summer winds. Up till then, Heather had been training to become an astronaut. Or at least, that's what she liked to tell people. No one ever believed her, of course, but that was the joy of it. Their scepticism as she doggedly stuck to her story, adding ever more unlikely details onto the creaking, swaying stack of unlikely details. "They make us sleep in our spacesuits," she would say, "even when we're at home. It's difficult for married couples, so the government supplies them with special double spacesuits they can wear at the same time." Or, "An important part of astronaut training is wrestling to see how strong we are. Only the very strongest and most agile can become astronauts, but anyone caught biting is expelled." Or, "When you go to space, they give you freeze-dried water to drink. You add water and you get more water. The only problem is this water is twice as heavy as it has twice the amount of water in it, so astronauts spend a lot of time weeing."
We'll avoid spoilers. We'll avoid the second half of the book. But is the garden in the title referring to the Garden of England?
Yes, I think so. So it's very much heightened English countryside, or British countryside, shall we say, since you're Scottish. And my family's from Dundee as well, so we've got to take these into account. But I grew up in Lincolnshire, so it's very much based on that kind of flat, wild, rural Lincolnshire countryside with the little island villages. Oh, these dozens and dozens, hundreds possibly, of little tiny villages that you probably will have heard the name of, but you've never been to. So it's that kind of setting. So it's ostensibly the Garden of England, and you could read it as the Garden of Eden, but probably more the Garden of England.
I'd grown up in Scotland, the perpetual summer does sound nice, but it has its downside.
Yes, I think actually one of the things in this book is that people do get a bit sick of it eventually, that they start just, the first couple of years, this is great, no more horrible winters, and then they do just get sick of it in the end.
Now, your background is in screenwriting. Is this a sort of screenplay that couldn't be filmed?
Yes, this is my first screenplay. This is my first attempt at writing a screenplay. I started the idea a long time ago, so I've been percolating it for a while. And I started writing it, got really into cinema, but didn't at the time know how to write a screenplay. And I didn't know how much of a screenplay is kind of left to your imagination. And even the most unusual films, and art house films, there's a lot suggested that's left to your imagination. So I ended up writing this 400-page screenplay, scratching my head, going, it's a fairly straightforward story of just some people going on a road trip and they get stuck in one place and go towards another. Why has it ended up so long? But it's just, I had far too many ideas for it. I think a lot of which your imagination intuits from watching one of the films which inspired it was Celine and Julie Go Boating, which itself is 3 hours long and is quite a fairly simple story. So I still had it percolating over in my mind for years, but over lockdown, just to be a cliche, when it came to lockdown, I was furloughed from work. I sat down and thought, right, my project's going to be to actually do something with this story that I really like, but just has never quite worked as a film, certainly in that form. So it found its proper home as a novel. I was able to stretch my legs out a bit and make full use of the room that you get in a book, because you could obviously, a book has no budget, whereas a film has to be a certain length and you have to be able to pay for everything that happens on screen. A book, you can let your imagination run wild. So yes, it's a much better fit as a novel, I think.
It would also fit quite well as a radio drama, because again, there is no real budget for special effects on radio.
Yeah, I think it could do. I mean, I would certainly like it to be a film. I think it's one of those things that now it's been a book and I've got all the ideas in it that I want to be in it, that it can then adapt back into a... This is me not wanting to rule out it being a film. Desperately backtracking. No, I do want it to be a film, honest. That I think sort of once it's been a book and once it's explored all the ideas that I want it to, that then it can be adapted back down into a film and lose some of the detail and be more visual and more focusing on the cinematic side. But I think a radio play as well would work really well. The one thing you'd miss, say the audio book has is the description of the landscapes and things like that, which is kind of like the book version of the cinematography. So I think it being boiled down to just the dramatic action and the voices would possibly lose that element of the scenic nature of it. But again, I don't want to talk myself out of of it being a radio play. So I'm open to all adaptations. But yeah, I think a lot of the fun that certainly I had writing it was the interaction between the characters.
That's what I was going to say. There's lots of dialogue in it. So were you reading it to yourself as you wrote it?
It's more this is also a bit of a cliche, and one that I kind of, when I heard writers talking about this before, I thought, oh, that's a bit of a cliche. This is a bit, I don't know. But actually, it turns out to be true that if you know the characters well enough, you can just let them do their own thing and they will talk more or less outside of your control. So the conversations between the characters, it's not even so much that I read them to myself, that they just, the characters did it, if that makes sense. So there's a bit where Heather, the main character, she's a bit of a wild card, a bit of a loose cannon, but kind of, you know, fun and energetic. But she's got a slightly weird family, and there's a bit where she's talking about her Uncle Michael, who's built a scarecrow in his garden called Kevin that he likes to wee up against when his wife is in the bathroom, or sometimes when she's not in the bathroom. I didn't think of that. This isn't something that consciously came into my head and I wrote down in my book. It's just a thing that Heather started saying as I was writing. So it Yeah, it's kind of, it does feel like a cliche saying it, but it's almost like a magical thing where the characters will, if you know them well enough, and they have a, and they know each other well enough, and they feel free enough to talk to each other in this way, that they will just have conversations, and you just kind of, you're the medium for it, for these odd conversations coming out. So that's a lot of fun when that happens.
Just running with that theme, did Antonia in her stand-up routine make you laugh?
Well, actually, on that occasion, so for anyone who hasn't read it, there's a whole section which is just the jokes from Antonia's stand-up routine. That one didn't happen spontaneously. So I, over the years, I've been annoying my Facebook friends with my terrible jokes. So I will think of puns and terrible jokes, and I'll put them on Facebook, and then I'll. So for this, I trawled back through. So they're all my own jokes, but these ones, I trawled back through Facebook and harvested the jokes back out and put them in. And people seem to have liked them, actually. I don't know if they're being more polite than my friends are, because my friends tend to roll their eyes when I post my puns on Facebook. But that was a lot of fun putting that in anyway, because I like to be a little bit experimental and just have these. I enjoy a list in a book. So a bit later on, there's a list of ice cream names as well, or just, and that's a list of jokes from a stand-up routine. So it's quite fun just playing with format a little bit.
Ice cream comes up quite a lot in the book, actually, and especially the chimes of an ice cream van in the background, leaving some reviewers I've heard with earworms of ice cream chimes in the background.
Yes. Well, it's so a big part of it, I think. It's called folk horror, but I think possibly a more apt name for the genre is, I think, would be nostalgia horror. So a lot of it is evoking childhood, and partly the signifiers of childhood, like ice cream, and the central character Heather, she's slightly obsessed about not growing up, and she wants to, even though she's in, it doesn't specify the age, but she's probably early to mid-20s, but she's decided she wants to stay a 7-year-old forever, and she becomes fixated as the journey goes on. She becomes fixated on the idea of, or just on wanting an ice cream. She craves ice cream and can't find one, and because it's this baking hot summer's day in perpetual summer, that the more and more she's on this road trip, the more she begins to crave ice cream, until we start to hear, not just her, but all the characters start to hear the chimes of an ice cream van that they can never quite find. So they chase the ice cream van, the chimes, but can never quite catch up with it, which would be a torment of childhood. It wouldn't be much fun. So yes, it's a lot of it's about evoking not just childhood signifiers and markers like that, but also the slight disorientation of childhood, or where you're still learning what's true and what isn't, what's real and what isn't, and also your brain's still growing, so there's a slight irreality to much of your childhood. So part of it's evoking that as well, I think.
After the strangers came, nothing was the same again. Voices on the radio told people to stay inside, and the people did. Voices on the radio promised the army would come and make things right. But the army never arrived, and soon most of the voices on the radio stopped speaking too. It took the people a while to figure out where this sudden influx of strangers had come from, exactly who they were. Immigrants who'd been sedated or hypnotized, perhaps, wandering blank-eyed across the countryside, loitering in public byways, utterly passive, arms by their sides, twitching mouths agape. Maybe refugees, mute from shock, fleeing some unknown catastrophe in one of the big cities. Before long, though, people began to recognize relatives they'd recently buried. There was Uncle Frank, lost to cancer a month ago, roaming the village streets. And there, too, was Grandma, gone after a tumble in her hallway, now blithely meandering across Headingham football pitch as if she'd never been away, as if she'd never been lowered into a hole in the churchyard in front of her sobbing relatives. They were all dead.
So that was the deliberate choice, because you mentioned chasing the ice cream van and disorientation. There are various threads in the book that are never pulled on. And I've heard it described as a fever dream. So that was a very deliberate choice from you.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by creating a deliberately or an authentic feeling dreamlike atmosphere, in particular that kind of, I think it's suitable for a horror book as well, a fever dream where it's not necessarily a pleasant dream that you're getting the rug pulled from under you in terms of what's real and what isn't. So yeah, so it was a quite a deliberate thing to create that sort of, I say trippy, but it's not really trippy. I've never done any of the stuff from which trippy gets its, you know, I've never done hallucinogens or anything like that. So it's very much inspired by, yeah, childhood fevers. And that's one of my, I don't know if evocative is the right word because that sounds too positive, but I still have a very strong sense memory of what it was like as a child to get those fevers. I don't even know if you even needed a fever. It was called Alice in Wonderland syndrome, which I still remember really vividly, is when things would seem too far away and too close up at the same time, or things would be too large and too small at the same time. So I had wood chip wallpaper in my bedroom. So I had sort of a very easy focal point on the wallpaper rather than just it being blank white walls. And this wood chip paper would seem way over in the distance, but also really close up against my face. Or the knots in my little comfort blanket, I could, like, they were too small to grip into my hand, but also huge. And I've always been fascinated by that kind of, I think it's to do with your brain growing and these kind of neurological things happening, and that sort of irreality of childhood where nothing, you're never sure of anything being quite fixed, and you're still learning about how things work and what isn't. The faceless man with long hair beside your bed, whether that's happening in your brain or whether he's really there. Well, that's another thing that I think it was a you know, what they call sleep terrors or a sleep paralysis thing. But I remember being awake in pitch blackness, and there's this man crouching beside my bed who I shouldn't have been able to see because it was pitch black. And me as a small child, they think, I don't like this, whatever this is, I don't like it. So yeah, evoking all that kind of disorientation of childhood.
I'll need to bleep this, but one sentence review that I read that made me laugh was, yeah, I loved it, but what the f*** did I just read?
Oh, I mean, that's good. Yeah, it makes sense to me. I understand what's going on, but I quite like, if people are bewildered by it but also enjoy it, then that's fine. It's all responses are valid.
Now, you mentioned being furloughed during lockdown. Your work is at Black Mills, and I believe someone inadvertently came in and recommended your book to other customers.
Yes, that was sort of an experience when it started to feel real. I work at the music shop in Blackwells, obviously because it's my little shop, and even though it's the music shop, I have my books on display there. And this young chap came in with a couple of his friends, and he saw the book and he said, "Oh, I love this book!" And he was picking it up and showing it to his friends and telling them about it. And I was sort of sidling over to him and earwigging a bit, and then eventually going, "Oh, I'm really enjoying hearing this because I'm the author." And he's like, "Well, no way!" So that was really fun. And he said he'd read it three times over summer. So it's not just somebody who'd liked the book; it's somebody who actually was really into it, which is so it. He was excited to meet me, but I think I was equally as excited to meet him as being someone who was very, yeah, very, very enthusiastic about the book. And, you know, like I say, beyond it just being a book that he'd really enjoyed reading once, it was actually something that he'd spent a large chunk of his summer rereading. So that's when it starts to feel real.
Now, at the start and peppered through this interview, we've heard clips of the book read by Fran Burgoyne. Did you have any hand in the choosing of her as the narrator?
Yes and no. So they sent over a sample of her audition for it for me to okay. So the publishers of the audiobook found the narrator, and I think that she's one that they'd used before. And yes, it was a very good audition, and I don't know how much I would say I would have had if I'd hated it, but I didn't. And I think she does an excellent job. But yes, I wanted to leave it up to the experts and the people who knew what they were doing with it. But yes, I was very pleased with the choice. And I think she's done a great job.
Did you find it a bit of an out-of-body experience listening to it?
It is a little bit, yeah. I mean, particularly, there's also the slight the gender remove, that obviously it's a woman's voice reading it, and I don't have one of those, so when I'm writing it and with my own voice in my head, and then it's someone else entirely who isn't me actually narrating it, and is putting slightly different emphases on different parts of it that I would, you kind of have to almost deliberately dislocate a bit and just enjoy it for what it is.
Was that ever on the cards of you narrating it yourself, and do you think you would have enjoyed that?
It wasn't. I think it's generally preferred that actors will read fiction books, and then non-fiction books, it tends to be the author who reads them. So I don't think it was ever on the cards for me to do it. I would have done it. I think I would have enjoyed it. So the difficulty for me would have been is that in real life, I don't swear. I'm not against it. I just don't. But it's unrealistic if my characters all talk like me. So I would have had to have read them effing and jeffing all over the place. I would have done it, but it's my parents are going to listen to this. But yes, no, I would certainly have done it, but I wouldn't have done as good a job as someone whose career it is to read and interpret audiobooks.
No, it is in audio. It's accessible to people for whatever reason, sight loss, dyslexia, whatever, don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's generally important anyway, but in terms of, you know, having a book that anyone can read and have an experience with, and it wouldn't be good for it to be cut off from people. So I think I was very pleased when I heard that it was going to be turned into an audiobook, because it does make it a complete experience.
If we download the book from the RNIB library, we'll miss the cover. Could you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Yeah, sure. So it's a photograph of a woman, long dark hair. She's facing away from camera, so we don't really know who she is. And she's wearing a very large crown of flowers woven together. And it's a very sunny day. It looks like it's probably late afternoon, but it's all tinted pink, which I like. So it gives it a slightly dreamlike atmosphere, that it's not just a straightforward photograph. It's tinted a kind of ice cream pink. And then the top half of the cover is a kind of an off-white cream-coloured band with the title, but kind of like the pink and the cream together give it an appropriately ice creamy coloured hue to it. So yes, it's summery, but the pinkness gives it a slightly odd dreamlike feel.
The ghosts never looked angry or fierce, but always perfectly serene, even as they clamoured to get inside. Like magpies, they collected weapons. They'd find cudgels and they'd strike if they got close enough. No one knew why. Despite the tranquility of her days, Heather found it difficult to sleep. Often the dead would bang their hands on her windows. They'd broken into other houses and killed the occupants. Most had been old people who couldn't escape in time, but it still worried her. What if she somehow slept through the whole thing?
Adam Leslie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
All Nero Book Award category winners are available in the RNIB library. Wild Houses, Lost in the Garden and Morrison Marlin are all available in audio, and The 12 is available in Braille with an audio version on its way soon. And let's return to author of The 12, Liz Hyder, for The Books of Her Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I mean, so many, really. I would max out my library card every week, pretty much. It's really hard to choose just one. I was going to go for Flotty Teacake by Hunter Davis, which it sort of isn't as well known as it should be, but I'm actually going to cheat and go for Quick Let's Get Out of Here by Michael Rosen, which I was introduced to by my primary school teacher, Mr. Froud, at Longshore in Chingford. And Mr. Froud, if you're still around, I salute you and thank you for introducing me to Michael Rosen. Quick Let's Get Out of Here is probably one of the books I've given most copies away to people. I've kind of forced it into their hands. All like little funny little moments. And there's a lot of humour in it as well. There's a character called Lizzie who plays football. And as a proud tomboy in my youth, who was the only girl who played football, I felt very seen, as the youngsters say, in the sort of, in Michael Rosen's stories. But I'd never read anything quite like it because I really felt like it is the sort of book that you feel that you're not alone, I suppose, in your sort of strange habits and quirks and weird little stories. So I think that's the one that I'll probably go for. I'd go for Michael Rosen. Who doesn't love Michael Rosen?
Me and my mate Haribo, we once made a go-kart. Everyone was making go-karts, so we had to make one. Big Tony's was terrific. Big Tony was terrific because Big Tony told us he was. What he said was, I am terrific. And because Big Tony was very big, no one said, Big Tony, you're not terrific. So, Big Tony was terrific, and Big Tony's go-kart was terrific, and that was that.
While Michael Rosen's quick Let's Get Out of Here isn't available in audio commercially or from RNIB, there is a copy read by Bob Rollett in the Calibre Library. Or, as you've just heard, you can hear Michael Rosen himself read poems from the book on YouTube. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, quite a few actually. It's quite hard to just pick one. I feel sort of a bit mean, but I just went for the one that popped straight into my head, which is actually a children's book. It's by Lloyd Alexander, and it's The Book of Three, which is the first in the Chronicles of, I always want to say Prydain, but I think it might be Pridden, Prydain. Don't know. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. That's a classic kind of reader thing, isn't it? Where you're like, I don't know how you pronounce it. It's a kind of fantasy series of five books that is, I mean, if I say it's like The Lord of the Rings with laughs and some female characters, you've probably got more of a sense of it. And I read it before I read Lord of the Rings. And I, much as I love Tolkien, I kind of preferred the Lloyd Alexander, I guess, because I read it first. But also there is humour in it and some female characters that actually get to do stuff. So yeah, I can go back to that every winter pretty much and just curl up and read that. Or again, Susan Cooper, The Dark is Rising. I would happily sit and curl up and read that. Or anything by Alan Garner. You know, they're all kind of books that you can fall into. And then when you look back up, when you kind of, you know, sort of feel like, oh, I will have a cup of tea now, that you feel like everything's slightly shifted around you, like the air's shifted around you somehow. And that's such a powerful thing to create through a story, I think.
By the time Taran woke, Gwydion had already saddled Melingar. The cloak Taran had slept in was damp with dew. Every joint ached from his night on the hard ground. With Gwydion's urging, Taran stumbled toward the horse, a white blur in the grey-pink dawn. Gwydion hauled Taran into the saddle behind him, spoke a quiet command, and the white steed moved quickly into the rising mist. Gwydion was seeking the spot where Taran had last seen Henwen, but long before they had reached it, he reined up Melingar and dismounted. As Taran watched, Gwydion knelt and sighted along the turf. "Luck is with us," he said. "I think we have struck her trail." Gwydion pointed to a faint circle of trampled grass. "Here she slept, and not too long ago." He strode a few paces forward, scanning every broken twig and blade of grass.
James Langton reading from the Prydain Chronicles Book 1, The Book of Three, which again isn't available from Amazon or RNIB Talking Books, but if you search for the Prydain Chronicles, Prydain, audiobook, you will find it. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
I would actually. It's by Eowyn Ivey, who is an Alaskan writer, and she wrote The Snow Child, which was a huge bestseller sort of some years ago. And then she wrote a brilliant book called To the Bright Edge of the World, which is just the most extraordinary book. The Snow Child is brilliant. To the Bright Edge of the World is one of my favourite books. I'm struggling to not cry as I talk about it because I just think it is, it's exceptional. She is a really extraordinary writer. She absolutely puts images in your head. She sings to your soul in her writing. You will absolutely feel like you are exactly where she's describing. You can kind of feel like the breath on your face. You can hear the rustle of the leaves in the trees. There's something about her writing that is utterly visceral. And she's just got a new book out, her third one called Black Woods, Blue Sky. And I think it's her best book yet. She just gets better and better. And it's set in Alaska. And however I describe it, it's not going to sound as good as it is. It's almost like a retelling of Beauty and the Beast, but for very much for grown-ups. And it is sinister and sad and beautiful and complex. And the tension that she builds up in the story is amazing. But like I say, you will feel like you are there. You can like smell the moss. You can kind of almost like reach out and touch the kind of the mushrooms growing on the tree trunks, you know. There's something about her writing that is it is like a breath of fresh air. I've never read anything quite like it. It is one of the best books I've ever read. I really don't say that lightly. But yeah, it's extraordinary. And it's literally, I think it's literally just come out like last week. So I'm sure there'll be an audiobook of it kind of any minute. And it treat yourself. It is extraordinary.
Birdie knew her mistake as soon as she cracked open her eyes. She was wholly sick, like she had the flu or been clubbed all around her head and body, and in the confines of the one-room cabin, she was increasingly aware of her own stink, how her skin was emanating the odor of cigarette smoke, digested alcohol, and vomit. She slid her arm out from under her daughter's head, and Emmeline rolled onto her other side but didn't wake. Little Emmeline, with her messy blonde hair and her warm pink cheeks. Birdie wanted to cuddle with her and go back to sleep, but the pounding in her head was only getting worse. She eased into a sitting position on the side of the bed and slowly stood up. A cold sweat trickled down the small of her back and from her armpits. She put a hand on the wall when it felt like her knees might go out from under her. When she looked down, she saw she was still wearing her same blue jeans and t-shirt.
That's Rebecca Lohman reading from Blackwood's Blue Sky by Owen Ivy, available in audio commercially. And once again, Liz Hyder, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer. That we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.